This is Will's Band of the Week for March 29th, 2010. Hello and welcome to another edition of Will's Band of the Week. This is Will, and live in studio, we have Chris this week.
What up, what up?
And also live in studio, we have Barrett.
Hey, everybody.
So we have a full studio tonight, and should we tell people how to contact us? I think we should. You can email us at willsband@yahoo.com. You can go to the website, willsband.net, post a comment, and just read it. Have fun. And subscribe from iTunes. We always recommend that because then it's delivered to your virtual door every week without you don't have to think at all.
And I forgot the list of the Facebook people that that befriended us this week. So you'll just have to settle for an implied hug.
And that ties in the Facebook page, which we have. And you can go to the...
I'm sorry, did I give it away?
Yeah. It's called the Will's Band of the Week Facebook page. Or no, the Will's Band of the Week podcast.
Right, make sure the word podcast is in there.
Because if it's not, you get that imposter guy. So, yeah, do that too. It's another way to contact us in today's social media world. Did anybody get... I didn't hear anybody get the identity of the background music that I put on last week's announcements. Did you guys catch that?
It sounded somewhat like, was it like a little Godspeed You Black Emperor, or was it Explosions in the Sky, something like that?
Nope. The first week it was Explosions in the Sky. This week it was a little-known band called Gravenhurst. The album is called The Western Lands, and the song is called The Collector. And I had this, we were talking last week about how La La used to be a music trading service, and I had this CD by Gravenhurst on my list to exchange, you know, for like a year and a half, and I never got it. And then a couple weeks ago, it went up on Amy Street for like a dollar or something. I thought, okay, this is my chance to get the Gravenhurst album. So it's actually pretty good.
Nobody got that? I can't believe that.
Yeah. Not many Gravenhurst fans out there, apparently. So, we don't have any actual music news except kind of a music subject this week. There's a new album that just came out that Chris is going to tell us about.
Yeah, just last week, a band that I like, The Bird and the Bee, also a favorite of my kids, came out with an album of all Hall & Oates covers. It's 1 to 9, just all Hall and Oates, just completely unironic covers of the classics. It's actually pretty good. You know, if you listen to it, you give it a listen all the way through. I mean, all the songs are recognizable, and you know, I think it's a pretty good listen. So,
Hall and Oates is one of those bands that that you know, of course, they've saturated the airwaves just ridiculously, and it seemed like they sort of had this formula, and they knew how to write a hit, right? You knew another one was coming soon in the next couple of months or whatever. And but I think if you just divorce yourself of just the fact that they're Hall and Oates, they had some good songs.
And I think when you take a band, you know, an indie band like this, and they do something like this, it would seem at first that it's completely tongue-in-cheek. But when you listen to it, I mean, they do it in earnest, and all the songs really work out. So I have a couple samples of the songs if you wanted to just kind of give the listeners an idea of what I'm talking about.
Sure. What should we start with?
Let's start with Kiss Is On My List.
Okay. This is The Bird and the Bee from the Hall & Oates cover album, which is called Interpreting the Masters, Volume 1. A tribute to Daryl Hall and John Oates. And this is Kiss Is On My List.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're doing that pretty straight. I haven't seen the track listing, but do they have some of the old ones like Sarah Smiles and stuff like that? Have you listened to that song, like the Hall & Oates version? It's stunning. I mean, it really is. I'm not even kidding. It's like, you know, this song is one of their 80s hits when they kind of got away from their soul roots. But they really had that Philly soul sound in the early days. And I heard them on NPR or something. And, you know, they could still deliver the goods, as they say.
Yes, in fact, Sarah Smile is on the album. So is Rich Girl, Private Eyes, She's Gone, Man Eater. Man, they've really gotten the ones. I mean, I'm just kind of surprised that I've heard of just about every one of these.
Yeah, when you actually go to, you know, the Hall & Oates, I think it's Rockin' the Soul Volume 1 or something, or whatever their greatest hits album is called. I mean, top to bottom, it's like 20 songs that are immediately recognizable. I mean, you forget how solid they were. But the whole purpose in me bringing this up, or, you know, I thought it might be interesting to discuss kind of what we think the rules for cover songs are, what makes a good cover song, whether, you know, what the circumstances of doing a good cover song are. I mean, if you're a band, do you take a cover song and put it on your proper album, or do you save them, you know, kind of for a compilation later? Or I think bands have done it either way, and it's kind of worked out for both. So,
yeah, that's true. Let's play one other track from this album, just so we round out the...
Just so it comes full circle.
Yeah, I mean, not really round it out, but give another little flavor of it. So this is I Can't Go For That. Well, using this as an example, I think that their sound and these songs go together pretty well because they have this punchy sound and what they need is just a catchy melody. And I think it works pretty well.
And thus brings me to, I think the reason that I like it so much is it follows my rule number one of being a good cover song, which is to play it in a different genre than the original song, which is to say, you know, you don't take, you know, kind of a folksy song and redo it again as another folksy song, or you don't take an R&B song and then do it again as an R&B song. This one, you know, adds a little electronic flavor to it. And so I just think it adds so much to the song when you don't just do a straight remake note for note, and you kind of reimagine it in a different way.
But as Barrett said, this is still fairly straight. I mean, they're not reinventing it, but they're giving it a different sound, but they're not, I wouldn't really call it a totally different genre.
Yeah, I mean, it's not, you know, torn apart and completely reconstructed. And, you know, we've all heard songs, cover songs that are, you know, changed so much that they become barely recognizable.
Right. There was just one I was listening to the other day and I couldn't even recognize it. In fact, it was after Chris brought this subject up, and I was searching my library for some cover songs that I had that we might play. One of them that I found is the band Fortet, which is a synth, mostly instrumental band, doing a cover of Iron Man by Black Sabbath. And I couldn't even recognize the song, but, you know, somewhere in there they used a little piece of the melody, but it was so different that it hardly even seemed like a cover of that song.
Right.
So, Barrett, since you've got the mic over there, we all picked a track to play as a good example of a cover. So, Barrett, why don't we play yours?
All right. I picked a song off of Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds album, Kicking Against the Pricks, which is it's an all-covers album by different singers. It's kind of like what Cat Power did with her, I think it was just called The Covers Record or Covers or whatever. And but these are older songs, and he the song I'm picking is a Jimmy Webb song made famous by the great Glenn Campbell, who I love unironically, at least like three of his songs, all the Jimmy Webb ones, and this is By the Time I Get to Phoenix.
By the time I get to Phoenix, she'll be rising. And she'll find that note that I left hanging on the door. And she'll laugh when she reads the part that says I'm leaving. Cause I've left that girl so many times before, and by the time I get to Albuquerque, she'll be working. And she'll take off time just to give me a call. And she'll hear
it's good. I like it.
Yeah, I didn't pick it out because it illustrates anything in particular that I wanted to say about cover songs, but I kind of looked at this assignment as a chance to get some Nick Cave on here. I'm not sure when we're going to do that again.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Well, it does bring up my second point, which is my second rule of cover songs, which is that it should probably be on an album that is either completely devoted to cover songs or some kind of compilation. Generally, I think bands shouldn't put cover songs on their proper albums. Although some have done, and in fact, the song that I actually picked out is on a proper album as well. So, but this is what I'm talking about as far as a song where they took the original song, you know, did it in their style, and it makes it, you know, kind of a completely new song. And I picked Minor Threat's version of the Paul Revere and the Raiders Steppin' Stone, which is barely recognizable, but I like it how they did it in their own style. So the song was popularized by the Monkees after the Paul Revere and the Raiders did it. So that's my pick.
Okay, this is Minor Threat. We'll be right back. some good old-fashioned punk rock. At the beginning, it sounded like it was recorded on a cassette recorder.
Yeah.
And then it kind of fades in the better quality sound.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
That's a good technique. Yeah, it brought me back. I was an American hardcore fan back in, 82, 83. So, but Chris, I'll take it back and pick up on a point that you made before we played the song. One of your rules being that, at least for you, you don't like it when you don't think that a band should put cover songs on their proper albums, or it should be all covers or kind of an all or none type thing, right? But look at, the early Beatles albums were lousy with extra, with lots of covers, Please Mr. Postman and Carl Perkins songs and Chuck Berry songs. And, they stopped doing that midpoint of their career, but they did that quite a bit and kind of with mixed results, I think.
Every rule has an exception. I think I generally agree with that rule. I think the best use of a cover is for a band to play as an encore in a live performance, if they can do a really good job at it, because then it kind of surprises the audience, and that would be my vote for the best use of a cover. I picked one which I think is on a proper album, but I think it might have been one of those things where it ended up on the proper album because it was a single that was successful, and then they thought, well, we got to put it on the album so the album sells. I'm not sure about that, but somebody can research that and find out that I'm probably wrong. But anyway, my pick is from a band called Saint Etienne, who did a cover of the Neil Young song, Only Love Can Break Your Heart. And I think it's a good example of a totally different genre. This is like a dance band doing a Neil Young song, so see what you think.
Yeah, I really like that. That's as soon as I came up, we came up with this as a topic, I immediately ran to iTunes and started going through songs. And, within 10 minutes, I had like 50 songs that I could have picked. I mean, there's like The Revolting Cox, Do You Think I'm Sexy? There's Devo's Can't Get No Satisfaction, or The Girl You Want, they do a really good version of. There's any number of great songs. There's one song by a band called Chibo Mato, who's two Japanese women, best known for their song Know Your Chicken. And they do a cover of Nirvana's About a Girl, where it's completely, it's just keyboards and drums, and it's just really whack. but it sounds pretty cool. So I actually, in going through my songs, found one that kind of, I've been making up these rules as I go along that violates pretty much every one of the rules. And to top it off, it's one of the other rules that I generally have is you shouldn't release a cover song as your first ever song. Now, I understand why a lot of bands do this, but you know, it gives them a jump start on their career because everybody's, hey, there's a song that we've heard before in a different way. But, you know, the musical landscape is just littered with bands who come out with a song that everybody knows, and then they just completely disappear because they don't have their own songwriting talent to back it up. So I picked a song called by a band called Orgy, who in 2001, I believe, came out with a version of New Order's Blue Monday, which is just a classic dance song. But they, I guess, just figured that, you know, we'll do it in the same genre. We'll make it as our first the first song off our first album, and you know, this will be the jump start to our career. So just play a little bit of that, and people get an idea.
Yeah, that's really bad. I remember hearing that around that time and thinking, what a horrible cover.
Yeah, I mean, there's no purpose to that song other than to jumpstart the career of the band Orgy. I mean, it's such a good song. It's such a classic song to begin with. To just update it and like, ooh, we got new sounds, you know, it'd be like saying we should remake The Godfather using CGI or something just because the technology exists or something. I don't know. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah. Good example of a bad cover, I got to say.
One more thing, another use of the cover that, you know, I don't know if you guys are fans of the band The Jam at all. They, you know, earlier in their career, they did Kinks covers, but not of hugely famous songs that, you know, a 17-year-old Barrett knew were by the Kinks. So these songs like David Watts and stuff, I just thought were Jam songs, and they fit in perfectly with the rest of their catalog.
Yeah, I remember hearing that song, and I didn't know it was a cover.
Yeah, I had no idea. And then later on in their career, when they kind of became, you know, before Paul Weller left and started the Style Council, he kind of took the Jam in like more of a soul direction. And they did an EP between albums with like a Curtis Mayfield cover of, the name of the song escapes me right now, and some others. So they were sort of signaling a change and using these covers to kind of, I don't know in what way they were using them exactly, but they did use them in a different way. And the songs were not really any more popular than the Kinks covers that they picked. And they just sort of fit in, at least in my mind at that time, as being Jam songs. And this is just what they're going to sound like now. And I really loved them. So that's another, and also The Clash, I think, did that on Sandinista. You know, they played Police on My Back is an Eddie Grant song. Again, who knew that then or now? I only knew it because I looked it up. But, you know, it's just sort of a way to go in a new direction in your career, and I think they did it really well, both those bands.
Maybe we should mention, too, that last week we were discussing Alex Chilton and just how many people did covers of Alex Chilton songs. And just today I was searching for some Alex Chilton covers just for reference, and the song 13 seems to have been covered a lot. Elliott Smith and Wilco both did covers of that song. And of course there are a whole bunch of them. Did you guys know, and this is sort of like one of those trivia things that's like I've heard several times, and so maybe it's wrong, maybe it's one of those things that just gets repeated, but they say that the song that's been covered more than any other song is Yesterday by the Beatles. And supposedly, you know, it's been recorded thousands of times or something.
I had heard that.
Yeah, so, I mean, who knows if that's true, but I suppose, as we've said before, there aren't any bands that big anymore, so there probably isn't going to be any more song that gets covered that much, right?
Probably not that much, but there will be songs. The only difference is there will be songs that are covered that nobody had ever heard before, just because right. There aren't those huge bands that, you know, ubiquitous songs that everybody knows.
Right. After we're all dead 100 years from now, there'll be a Neutral Milk Hotel song that's been covered 2,000 times, right?
Well, a couple podcasts ago, we talked about Simon and Garfunkel as well.
Oh, yeah.
And I just recalled that on some of their early albums, like they did a cover of Bob Dylan's The Times They Are A-Changin', things like that. So they did very much the same thing.
I'm surprised more people don't do covers of Simon and Garfunkel. A lot of good songs.
Yeah, I was trying, as you guys were talking, I was like trying to think of... Yeah, the Lemonheads, Mrs. Robinson.
Yeah.
Here's a band that started off doing just, well, not only covers, but were known for Bob Dylan covers before kind of forging their own identity, and that's the Byrds. I mean, they did a ton of Bob Dylan covers on their early stuff. And, you know, that wasn't thought of as novelty music or anything. Doing other people's songs back then was just a lot more common. I mean, the Beatles would do, you know, nearly half an album of covers. And, you know, so the Byrds were not unique in that.
I think a lot of that probably had to do with the scarcity of recording opportunities. So, you know, it was so rare to actually be able to get time in a studio in front of a microphone. You go ahead and try and pick the best songs that you possibly can, whether they're written by you or written by someone else. Now, these days, everybody, you know, three dopes in a room have a microphone in front of them, and, you know, the recording opportunities are everywhere. In fact, there's probably a case to be made that artists are putting out too much music now, that they're not being very judicious in what they put out. So I think that probably had to do with a lot of the covers as well.
You know, I'll say right now, the three of us could do a better cover of Blue Monday than that one, don't you think?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure.
Nice acoustic version.
Acoustic version. Yeah. All right. Oh, I wanted to mention one other cover just because I thought it was fun when I was looking for covers today. Judas Priest did a great version of the old Joan Baez folk song, Diamonds and Rust. And I was in college, so, you know, this is a long time ago. The live version by Judas Priest of Diamonds and Rust was popular on the radio, and I thought, wow, that's so cool. Seems like heavy metal was a good genre to do covers because, you know, there were all these songs that were never done in a power rock version, and you could do it, and if it was a familiar tune, you did it in a metal version, it would sort of be instantly catchy.
Are we going to hear a sample of that?
Well, I don't have the live version. And the studio one just isn't as good. So let's just, well, maybe they have it on iTunes. I just found it on iTunes. So here's a little preview.
Hand on the telephone, hearing a voice I've known a couple of light years ago, heading straight for a fall. Well, we both know what memories can bring, leaving diamonds and rust. Yes, we both know what memories.
You kind of have to know the song, or it's no good, but it was kind of cool when you knew the old folk song.
I think Will is being disingenuous here. He actually, I think he does own that album. He just didn't want to admit it. And I don't blame him. That's all right.
I did get the Judas Priest collection from the library. I thought, you know, I've got to have this in my collection. You got to have some Judas Priest in there.
That's what I always say. I think I'm breaking one of Will's rules by not having it.
Any Judas Priest?
Yeah, it's going to be on my gravestone. Got to have a little Judas Priest in there.
All right. We have a band this week, so now I think we've told you all about the rules of covers, and I hope everybody follows them and agrees with us. Our band this week is called Titus Andronicus, which It's the name of a Shakespeare play, which I had never heard of before.
I was an English major.
So I
had heard of it, but I've never read that.
Obscure Shakespeare play, then.
Not unlike my favorite obscure Shakespeare play, Coriolanus, which you'd never heard of, apparently. But I've actually read it, so therefore it's one of my favorites, so I can throw it out there and impress people.
Wow, I am pretty impressed.
He wrote the screenplay, too, for Smokey and the Bandit. A lot of people forget that.
All right, well, Titus...
Actually, they just made a movie of Titus Andronicus. I think it's called Hot Tub Time Machine.
Well, this is a band from New Jersey, and they just came out with their second album called The Monitor, and it is long, and it's, I'd say, ambitious, and it takes a while to get to know, so we're here to help you get to know it a little bit. Barrett, you got anything to say about it?
Well, I really liked it a lot. You know, it's kind of, I'm not sure how old these guys are, but they don't strike me as being terribly old. And this is, like you said, it's just a big, ambitious thing. And it gets to be a little bit of a mess at times. But there are some moments in here that I think are just astounding. And I think in order to, you know, one of the three of us here does not like the album. I'll give you in the... This person has his arms literally folded again.
Oh, we have the arms folded situation.
Yep. And I can tell you why Chris doesn't like these things and why it was predictable that he wouldn't. Chris doesn't like a band called The Hold Steady. He doesn't like them. Chris is not a big bright eyes guy, to kind of coin a Chris phrase. And Chris also does not like Ockerville River. And if you don't like any of those things, then maybe you ought to just turn off the podcast. Or if you're doing the podcast, maybe you ought to just go home. No, sit back down. But
when I heard this, I definitely heard the old Conor Oberst, kind of the early Conor Oberst, Bright Eyes stuff. But I think there's a little clash in there, too.
Maybe. I hadn't heard that. I mean, it's
I think the shouty vocals maybe is what made me think of the Clash.
So let's play something, and then we'll give Chris a chance to defend his dislike.
Do you have a first pick, Barrett?
I'm gonna pick the song called A Pot in Which to Piss.
This is right in the middle of the album, track 5.
The audience was large and brilliant. Upon my weary heart was showered smiles, modest, and flowers. But beyond them, I saw thorns and troubles and new bumps.
We got a couple of gun blades.
Well, there's not quite 3 minutes of a song that's almost 9 minutes long. There are a lot of long songs in this album that take a while to develop. So that's part of the reason why it took me a while to absorb this, because, well, you know, an 8 minute track is one thing, but then an album over an hour long, I could never, I think we've talked about this before, I could never find a time where I could actually listen to the whole thing. So I'd be in the car and I'd hear 15 minutes and I'd be halfway through a track, and it just took a while.
Here in Will's library, he's got a book on the shelf called Arthur Ashe Portrait in Motion, a diary. And during that song compelled me to pull out this book and read a little bit of it. And so this is what I think of that song is, I was reading this passage. I was standing with a bunch of friends at Leroy Haynes's restaurant, and this absolutely gorgeous American girl came up to me and said flat out, "I'd really like to make love to you. If you have some time while you're in town, would you please give me a call?" Straight from the mouth of Arthur Ashe. That's pretty much what I think of that song.
All right. Well, see, he couldn't look at Facebook because he's not on his computer here. We've got him imprisoned in the studio.
No, okay. Here's what I think of this album. The first few songs, I actually had some hope. I believe I actually told you guys that I liked the album after just a cursory listen.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it just goes on and on and on and on. And it's part of this kind of whole neo-Springsteen revivalist New Jersey bar band type of vibe. And that song didn't give you a real flavor of it just because it was kind of, you know, slow and meandering. Yeah, I mean, it's. I think the Hold Steady comparison is apt, especially considering Craig Finn of the Hold Steady actually makes an appearance on this album. So they're all plotting against me, it appears. But I guess the one song that that caught me is the second song, which is called Titus Andronicus Forever, which is immediately catchy and listenable. So that I think that's why I had high hopes for it, but then the rest of it kind of tails off for me. So if I had to pick a song, that would be the one.
It's one of the few short songs on the album, so we'll play 60% of it. Here you go. Titus Andronicus Forever. Sort of a rocking out chant that sort of is a continuation of the first track, actually, I think. But maybe they figured they had to divide it because the first track was already 7 minutes long.
One thing I noticed about that song is the singer is being very coy about where exactly the enemy was.
Right.
Wasn't letting us in. Or did he? No, it's everywhere. Okay, right. He did say that. Now that I think back. We could do a playback later and see if he actually did say where the enemy was. But
I think there is sort of a highlight track in this album. And you're going to have to bear with me because you really have to let this one play for 3 minutes plus so that you can see how it develops. But the whole track is actually over 8 minutes. So I think this is a good representation of the album. And it's a song called Four Score and Seven.
Wall we can after 10,000 years, it's still us against them and my heroes. I've always died at the end. So who's going to account for these sins? And I don't know who here's my friend. Well, I'm certain that I've seen a man. Christ, fuck me if I can remember when. Will I never be lonely again? And the times are returning once more. Six gun-winged devils line up at my door. Each one is more evil than that which came before. Seven angels finally stood across the floor.
Yeah, I'm glad you picked that one, Will. That one is quite representative, I think of the album. I don't know that any of us have even mentioned that this is kind of a concept album.
Right.
And people just don't do those anymore. But Titus Andronicus did, and this one's about the Civil War. And, you know, Chris has professed to not really being much of a lyrics guy. You know, in this album, I think you could spend quite a bit of time sitting down and trying to figure out what exactly they're saying in some of these songs. And maybe some of them are like, you know, there are parts where they're singing as, you know, Southerners and sometimes it's as Northerners. But I'm guessing that overall they are taking the side of the victorious North in this.
I would think that would be the most likely. Yes.
That would be the popular way to go. And they're from New Jersey. And I don't know that it'd be worth finding out what a bunch of 20-whatever-year-olds have to say about the Civil War, but it's an album that's dense with you know, lyrically dense and the imagery. And also I heard in the times that I've listened to it, pretty much each time I hear it, I'll hear something new, just like sly little references, like a little Elvis Costello reference. And a little Sex Pistols reference over here. And there's even, they did a couple of lines from a Billy Bragg song. I'm like, I think if you spent a lot of time with it, you'd pick out, you know, many, many more things like that. So I think there's just a lot there besides just the music going on for me that just makes it a little bit more interesting. And I think the music is great. I like the, you know, the New Jersey Springsteen kind of thing. You probably don't like Marat either, that band from Philly. He's going like, meh. So, yeah. But I like that stuff.
I think musically, too, it's really dense. And it's one of those albums that you just have to decide how much time you want to put into it. Because the more time you put into it, the more you get out of it. But then you might not want to put the time into it if it hits you like it hit Chris, apparently.
It rewards repeated listening.
Yes.
Chris.
I'm too busy listening to albums of Hall & Oates covers.
Right, that's...
To put too much time into this.
That's right.
That's where I sink all my efforts.
Yep, so did you guys ever hear their first album? This is their second full album, and I remember hearing about the first one, and I never got it, and it was one of those where I kind of thought about getting it, and I never did. You guys are both nodding no. So I get the impression the first one is not so sprawling, and it might have more sort of condensed, you know, limited to reasonable 4 or 5 minute long tracks.
Yeah, I mean, I like this well enough that I'll buy it and let you guys listen. Well, I'll let one of you guys listen to it. Well,
okay, I will. All right, well, maybe we ought to leave it at that since we played some pretty lengthy segments there. And anything else you guys think that we need to tell the listeners this week? Anything of great import?
While that last song was on, I was looking through the State of Wisconsin Blue Book, reading up on Wisconsin's first black legislator.
Mm-hmm. And what did you find out?
His name is Lucien Palmer from Milwaukee, and he was elected in 1906, right after a white guy named Palmer. So a lot of people think he just got elected because people confused the names, and then once they figured it out 2 years later, he lost.
Wow.
So it was just like the topic of the subject of the Distinguished Gentleman with Eddie Murphy, where he goes around running for Congress under the same name as the guy who died, and he accidentally gets elected.
You know, I was talking to somebody from Australia, and did you know that in their elections, there's some big deal about who gets to be first on the ballot, and there's some great, important consequence to the order on the ballot, and I'm not sure this is going to show my ignorance now, because all I know is like this is an issue, but I don't know what the issue is. But apparently you really want to get like a certain position on the ballot, and if you do, you're like, you know, way more likely to get elected. So maybe I need to research that more, because now what I've just said basically means nothing.
Yeah, here different communities have different orders and of names on the ballot. So no one person is always the first on the ballot. So there you go.
Okay. We're always happy to educate people on just anything we feel like talking about, right?
I grabbed the microphone from Chris, and these guys looked at me like...
Come on, we were expecting something really brilliant.
Well, we were talking about the names and things and people using maybe a name that they think will get them elected. I can think of in recent political history, George W. Bush picked a president that was only like barely, you know, it was like, what, 8 years before?
Yeah.
Like, dude, give me a break. We all remember that guy, but people apparently forgot and thought it was the same guy. And he won two terms, which would have been a total of three, because those guys were not related in any way, as far as I know.
Somehow I recall some woman running for president. Her name was Clinton or something like that, and I'm sure she made it all on her own without any help from anyone else. That she would totally be taken seriously as a presidential candidate had her last name not been Clinton. So how does that work?
Welcome to the Will's Politics of the Week podcast. We'll have to spice this up with some more of this maybe sometime. So, but I think for now, we're running up on the close to 1 hour mark, and it's time to sign off, I think. So, good night, everybody.
Peace out, knuckleheads.
Good night.